You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, did you ever make a mixtape for your crush? Are you the go-to DJ for road trips, parties, workouts, trivia contests? We want to hear from you. We're talking about the history of playlists and how to make your next playlist stand out. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about two Appleton sisters and their love of reading.
Beth Lowe grew up spending most of her free time immersed in books. Now living with her sister, Mai J. Lo Lee, she has come to find that her love for reading has had a positive influence on her family, despite how her parents felt about it. The sisters talked with one another about that experience as part of a StoryCorps mobile tour stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
My name is Beth Lowe. I am 49 years old.
My name is Mai J. Lo Lee. I am 43 years old today. So Beth, how does it feel being the older sister and not having an older somebody to go to?
You know, it's funny you say that because on the way over here, we're referencing that you and the younger sisters each had a sibling, a playmate that you can hang out with.
Talk boys,
yes,
talk girls.
Talk boys, yeah, talk makeup gossip, yep. As you transition into your preteen, teen years. And I was just saying, I have nobody in our culture, and we are Hmong. I'm the oldest, so there's never that effort to get friends or people that you can talk to outside of your familial setting. So it was quite lonely growing up being the oldest girl in the family.
Do you think that's why you like books so much?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me why you like to read so much, and what do books mean?
I think if you ask anybody who loves books, it's just you get into the page and you become the characters. You become where you go, where they go. You feel what they feel.
You live with me now. You've been living with my family for 2 years, and I cannot tell you like how you've normalized reading for my daughter.
Yes.
Because whereas like with her peer group, enjoying reading is not seen as cool. And I try to do it in front of her all the time. But for her, when she saw you do it like during your free time and not watch TV, not use your phone, where you always had a book in your bag or you had a book in every room or a book, like for her, she's like, I can put a book in every free space.
Yeah.
You know, and I just really appreciate that because for you living with us, that's really normalized, like very for her, like it's normal to read. Everybody should read, but it's okay to read whatever you want.
Right.
You know, and for her to like know that that's like normal. Because, you know, in our household, that was not normal.
Right.
We used to get yelled at for reading.
Well, as you remember, our mother would literally come take the books out of our hands and rip it out. And I remember I think it was last week, you were asking Senya to go do something. And she's like, Mama, I'm reading. And I think you just silently closed the door and just walked out because what can you say when your child is like, what do you mean I can't? I'm reading.
I felt so triggered when I was like, go do your chores and stop reading. And I thought, trauma.
You know, right.
Like I was like, I had to go journal. I had to go write about like, how do I feel? What is that? Because I remember my mom and our parents yelling at us about reading too much or that this wasn't going to be a skill set that like brides needed.
Right.
You know, and I had to explain to her, like, just so you know, Grandma and Grandpa were not encouraging of us reading. You know, and I remember when you went off to college, my dad had a book burning out in the farm because he's like, what the hell am I going to do with all these thousands of books?
Yeah.
And then he just had this big bonfire and just threw all the books in there. And I didn't realize like what it meant at the time or all of that stuff. But I just thought he burnt books because he didn't want the younger kids to read it or to be influenced by it or to like go to college.
I think you and I, we snuck it in wherever we could. Thinking back to my youth, that was one of the rebellious things that I could have done in terms of from a cultural perspective. Sadly, our mother would never say, we have a daughter who reads. It's always, I have a daughter who reads. So there's that hint of shame in that. And I appreciate you saying that about me influencing your daughter in a small capacity.
Oh, no.
That's beautiful.
That's a big capacity. You know what a big capacity that is.
That was Beth Lowe and Mai J. Lo Lee of Appleton. Their interviews were recorded at StoryCorps, a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of WPR and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Now, mixtapes, compilations, playlists, whatever you want to call them, people have been making these love letters to their favorite music for decades. And music lovers have a lot of opinions about what makes a good playlist. Here's John Cusack's character Rob in the 2000 movie High Fidelity.
Now, the making of a good compilation tape is a very subtle art. Many do's and don'ts. You got to kick it off with a killer to grab attention. Then you got to take it up a notch. Then you got to cool it off a notch. There are a lot of rules.
Our next guest studies the music streaming industry and is here to share his own rules for making a great playlist. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story about making or receiving an especially memorable mixtape or CD or online playlist from a sibling, friend, a crush? Do you like listening to or making playlists on music apps? Do you have a list for every occasion? What is the key to a great playlist? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeremy Morris is a professor of media and cultural studies in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison, where his research focuses on digital music and media. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Did you make or receive actual physical mixtapes or CDs back in the day, or maybe you still do?
Definitely remember making some playlists on mixtapes, recording from one stereo to the other, and then moving into the burn CD era, where we're finally able to put songs from computers onto disc. And then, now trying to, I don't make as many now, but trying to stay active on Spotify, making playlists there.
Now, like many things in my life, I do things in kind of a half-baked way. And that's how I did mix cassettes and then CDs and then playlists. Not a lot of thought, not a lot of effort. Even though I love music, do you have rules, hard and fast rules, or like vague guidelines that motivate how you make a set list?
Yeah, I think it's hard. It depends, I think, on the kind of playlist that you're making, right? We have playlists that are kind of units of communication, right? We want to send a message to somebody. And so if that's the case, then you want to think about how are you going to say, what do you want to express, whether that's to your partner, whether that's to your kid, whatever, whoever you're making it for. You can also think about playlists as sort of sonic resources, right? Is it to score a party or an event that's happening, right? So there'll be different rules that apply depending on the kind of playlist. And then also thinking about playlists as kind of memory, like a moment in time, right? Some people make best of 2023 playlists because they want to remember what they were listening to this year. So I think the rules change depending on the kind of playlist that you're making.
Now suppose, and a lot of that movie High Fidelity was about making that playlist for a potential significant other. I'm really bad with lyrics, so I might pick songs that turn out to be very unromantic or anti-romantic. I wouldn't touch that, but you have thoughts on setting up a playlist with that goal in mind.
Yeah, I think that's the hard part, right? Is music has lots of meanings to it, and people are going to take the songs differently. So it may mean something to you, and you may have crafted the thing that you think is perfect for the person that you're crushing on. it may land completely differently, right? But hopefully what you're sharing is part of your identity, right? These are some of the songs that I like. These are some of the things that mean something to me, or these are something that remind me of you, and this is why I'm putting that together, right? So I think back to those playlists that I made for other people in that way. It was often like, this is a thing that reminds me of us or of moments in our time together, right? So if you can find songs that evoke those moments, that evoke that familiarity, that can be a really, really powerful connection with the person, right? I recently made some for my kids, so, and it was almost like they were just starting to get into music, right? So it was that kind of intimate moment between parent and kid about, like, hey, this is a whole world that happened before you were here. Let's talk about some of that.
We are talking about making mixtapes or mixed CDs or playlists for ourselves or to share with others for different occasions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite memory or if this is something you do all the time now, whatever technology you use, love to hear about it at 800-642-1234. We asked around here at Wisconsin Public Media. Clint Walls from PBS Wisconsin sent us this memory of making mixtapes.
I go back to the days of mixed cassettes, and the order and the flow of the songs are really the key. But in addition to those things, you really do need to keep it interesting. For all my mixtapes that I gave to friends, I'd include a message from children's read-along 45s, like this.
You will know it is time to turn the page when you hear the chimes ring like this.
Throwing in those little curveballs like movie quotes recorded from a VHS player, and putting them at the beginning or the end of a tape's side kept things fun and memorable.
the production value, Jeremy. I never did this. I have friends who did, who went in the physical media and the case and sound effects and things like that. Have you gone to that level of mixtaping?
Yeah. So I remember I used to make mixtapes on tape, and we were going to play them in the car as we were driving to the ski hill that was about 40 minutes away from my where I lived. We were listening to rap music. It had swear words in it, and my parents were the ones driving us. So we were actually, as we were recording, we had a microphone set up, and we would cough over the swear words. So we would like produce radio edits
nice.
During the process so that we could listen to these songs still and hope that our parents didn't really notice.
Now, how much has technology changed? I mean, it was one thing to make a thing on a cassette. That's a big pain. A little easier, I found, with CDs. It almost seems too easy in some ways with some digital media, like, well, that's no effort at all. I don't know. How does that change the philosophy of our mixtapes?
Yeah, I mean, I think making a playlist has always been an art, and that what's changed is the tools we use to make that art, right? And so I think there's some limitations to all technology. And so what's really neat is how people use that technology. So like in the one we heard, right, it's like neat to insert things. It's harder to do that on Spotify. Mm-hmm. You can't really, you know, just take a movie quote from somewhere and put it in, right? So you have to be kind of creative there. Spotify or iTunes, you know, or Apple Music, they give you access to massive amounts of catalogs. So it's great in that sense, right? You can really mine the depths of popular music history to create a message for someone. You know, but then there's the drawbacks of it, right? Yeah, is it too easy? Or I worry a little bit more about, you know, some of the things about data and the way that playlists mm-hmm. are now, you know, designed to help kind of track our behaviors and our sort of patterns, right?
Talking to Jeremy Morris, professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison, talking about making music playlists, from philosophies about what makes a great track list to advice for how you can make sure your next playlist hits all the right notes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have playlists, or maybe ones you shuffle, or actual cassettes or CDs that you listen to when you're working out, when you're cooking, when you're studying, or when you have friends over? Do you make compilations for other people, or do you have a favorite memory of someone who made one for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or do you just like to leave it to an algorithm now? You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
The most important track is number one. It's got to be familiar, but also unexpected. Most importantly, it's got to make you feel good.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. That's a clip from the Hulu TV adaptation of the movie and book High Fidelity, starring Zoe Kravitz, the song David Bowie's Modern Love. Jeremy Morris is with us, media professor at UW-Madison, and we're talking about the art of making the perfect playlist for any occasion, including picking a first track that'll make an impression. You can join in with your memories of making a mixtape, a mix CD, a playlist for a friend, giving or receiving. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller. Jay is with us in Whitefish Bay. Jay, hello.
Hi. Yeah, I had a friend who sold records, and I had a lot of favorite one-hit wonders from the 50s and 60s. So he went ahead and made me, I gave him a list of all the songs that I wanted, all the, you know, the one-hit wonders that I liked. And then in 76, when I traveled around the country, I had a group of friends that had tape decks that were able to make tapes for me of classical music and all the albums that I really liked. And it made traveling around the country much more enjoyable and always kept me close to home.
Fantastic. Jay, I want to make clear, your friend actually burned a vinyl playlist for you of your favorite one-hit wonders?
It was on, not a vinyl,
okay.
It was on... a tape.
Okay.
And I still have it now. It's been like, it's, you know, 40-some years old, and it's still...
The cassette still works.
40 years ago.
That's pretty good. I had tapes that disintegrated after a year or two. Jay, thanks a lot for that call. I love that story, but also traveling around the country and swapping mixtapes with friends. I don't know if that's something that people do anymore. I love that concept, though.
Yeah, no, and again, you know, these things are memories of places, of who we were, of where we were, right? So, like... music is so intimately connected to our memories of ourselves that, like where you are when you're listening, if you remember a particular music scene that was in the city you lived in, right? All of that stuff's really important.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Heard from a couple people on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Carol writes, when a friend got divorced, I had a CD made for her of every possible version of I Will Survive. It was great fun. Carol, thanks a lot for sharing that. There's that, that theme, but also sending a message.
Yeah. Yeah, and I love also setting the parameters mm-hmm. of this, right? Like, the other great thing you can do with thinking about a playlist is what are the parameters that you're going to adhere to as the creator of this playlist? So I just made a playlist that was called Long Songs, and it was everything had to be over 7 minutes long because I wanted to just drive my family crazy when I uh-huh. listened to it, because they don't really like songs that go on that long, right? But, setting parameters like that can be a real kind of creative spark for you.
Did Inagata DeVita by Iron Butterfly make the list at 17 plus minutes?
I should. I got to go back and add it.
Because they'll love that.
Yeah.
It's a favorite of mine. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Evan is with us in Madison. Evan, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your mixtape story?
Well, mixtapes have been a part of my life forever. It's how I've gotten many girlfriends. How else are you supposed to express your feelings without, being a confident person?
Evan, what's the secret? What's the secret to having the perfect first song on a mixtape to impress that potential significant other?
You have to know what they like as well.
Got it. Evan, thanks a lot for the call. Going with your audience there, I think my mistake on mixtapes is, here's a bunch of songs that I like, hope you like them too, rather than putting my audience in mind.
Yeah, no, they're definitely a form of communication, right? And any form of communication requires both telling and listening. Yeah. So,
Evan, thanks a lot for sharing that. I appreciate it. Tim on Facebook writes, I've been doing this for decades. I love music of a lot of flavors, and I like to construct things that either have themes or some sort of sonic trip or a surprise. Interesting. So Tim does it a lot of different ways. I don't know your thoughts on developing a theme and or a flow in a mix, a compilation, Jeremy.
Yeah, and I think that's important. And again, you said you're not really big on lyrics, right? I'd say the same for me. But, you can see people who will do playlists that are all based on a kind of lyrical progression throughout the thing. Personally, I sort of go with mood, like what are the, is this a guitar song? Is it really upbeat? Then that has to be followed by another one like that. Is this the calm part of the and how do you get from those calm sections to the louder ones? Everybody's going to have a different take on how to do that successfully. But I think a good playlist feels like it makes sense when one song comes after the other because of the tone, because of the instruments, because of the genre of music, right?
As a musician, I've played in bands with people who had very strict rules about song sequencing. Two rocking ones, then a slow one, or never play a song in the same key back to back, or things like that. Do you think that rules like that, and I don't know if they make any sense. I don't know if anybody actually cares, but do you have rules like that in mind when you're making a list?
I don't, because I think that the best playlist will surprise you and will break those rules, right? And so that, again, that clip of somebody throwing in the children's records or, that kind of stuff is exactly what will sort of surprise you. But yeah, I generally think about mood and how you want the playlist to go. You can have a whole playlist of sad songs, right? And it can be in this space. You don't necessarily have to have dynamics, right? So I don't know if there's rules. There is a feeling that a playlist evokes, and everybody's particular take on that feeling is what makes the mix and the playlist unique.
Now, Maureen McCollum here at WPR told us a lot of her playlist memories are from dance parties, and she has an interesting recommendation, Music League, a website that invites groups of friends to submit songs based on a common theme that vote on the tracks. So it's a perfect combination, she says, of collaborative and competitive. Jeremy, what do you think? I hadn't heard about that, this idea of collaborating online to create these playlists.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that new digital playlists do allow that's really interesting. Spotify has a feature like that as well, where you're able to make a playlist with friends in real time, right? So it's really neat that you could have a party where everybody's connected to the same system and the playlist is like the jukebox at the bar before, right? So we've had examples of those things in the past, like the jukebox, but this sort of brings it to that personal, to that intimate level where friends are collaborating and as was said, they're competing in some cases, right? Like because there's a voting mechanism there, right? So it's always going to be an interesting experiment when you're collaborating with multiple people with a variety of different tastes, and you're going to create something great.
And our own Rochelle Wilson, producer here on Central Time, pointed toward a Facebook group called Oddly Specific Playlists. 360,000 members. Requests range from 90s country wine mom vibes to songs that make you feel like you're taking a leisurely drive through outer space to gaze at all of the planets and stars. Have you ever gotten that specific with a playlist, Jeremy? Except for your 6 minute plus one.
Yeah, the 6 minute one is one. I had a playlist that a friend created for me, which is like, I've already given up on trying to get back into baseball, you know? And so, like, there are times where I think you can play around with the title of it. But yeah, no, that group, that Facebook group is a wonderful example. And again, you see that on other digital media too, like Netflix, the way that it tailors content to us in such specific ways. I don't think it's surprising that we react by doing that ourselves when we're creating things.
And finally, Jeremy, quick question. You've made a digital playlist for yourself. Shuffle or linear order?
Depends on the thing. You know, so again, if it's that communication to somebody, it's a message and I'd love to have it received in the order that it was laid out, right? But if you're syncing something for a party or if I'm going for a run and I have a batch of songs that are all at the same pace so that I'm running at the exact same tempo, it doesn't really matter as much, right? So I think it's, again, depending on who the audience is, what the purpose of it is.
Jeremy, thanks again for coming up to the studio.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
That's Jeremy Morris, professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. His research focuses on digital music and media. He joined us to talk about the art of making music compilations from the old days of mixtapes to the streaming services we use today. Keep sharing your mixtape and playlist stories on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, air travel could be better for consumers, a lot better. That's according to the author of the new book, Why Flying is Miserable. He joins the show with some solutions. Plus, a new book from Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss. He joins the show as well. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The city of Milwaukee is trying to promote housing growth at a time when we're seeing a mismatch between the housing stock available and the needs of Wisconsin communities. Last week, we heard from UW-Madison urban planning professor Kurt Paulson about that mismatch around the state and the need for additional housing. He said zoning requirements need to change in many communities. Today, we're learning more about a potential solution in the works for Milwaukee that could offer a path forward for other cities around the state. The city is undergoing an initiative called Growing MKE that aims to change Milwaukee's comprehensive plan to update zoning codes in ways that make it easier for developers to create more housing in the city's neighborhoods. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had trouble finding a place to live where you want to live that you can afford? Do you want to see your community update its zoning codes? Do you want to see a wider variety of housing types in neighborhoods, mixing, say, single-family homes with duplexes or other housing units? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Sam Likling is the city planning manager for the City of Milwaukee's Department of City Development. Sam, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Rob, and thanks for having me.
Start us off by telling us a little, please, about this Growing MKE initiative.
Well, thanks. I think you hit on it earlier. There's a lot of discussions going on both statewide and here at the city on how do we meet the housing needs of a changing population. And I think we're excited to be tackling that issue head on at the City of Milwaukee. Obviously, our mayor, Mayor Cavalier Johnson, has been explicit about his goals for wanting to see the city grow and also wanting to make sure that we're meeting the housing needs of our residents. And so Growing MKE is an initiative to have a really thoughtful and broad-based discussion about how will Milwaukee choose to grow. We want to use this process to talk about how we'll encourage housing growth and choice through our zoning codes and our land use policies, and use the feedback we get from the public to really set that growth for housing growth and choice in the city of Milwaukee moving forward.
Now, I think for most people, if they're going to read zoning codes, it's at bedtime, maybe as a sleep aid, but it's important stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about how zoning works and how important it is in determining what happens in a community?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think at a high level, it's important to know that what zoning is, it's the set of rules and regulations that affect what gets built. And that's why everyone should care about it. And the history of zoning you asked about was, you know, most cities, Milwaukee in the 1920s passed its first zoning code. And that set rules for what can happen on each individual parcel, and also what building designs would look like, how tall a building could be, how close to the street it has to be. And one of the initial reasons zoning was adopted was to separate uses and protect the public health. For example, you didn't want a rendering plant next to a single family house. And so zoning was initially used to address nuisance issues, but it's also over time evolved to be something that's very explicit about what can be built and where. And obviously, as you're hearing kind of the national discussion on zoning, we as a planning profession have also had to grapple with the fact that in some cases, people have used the tool of zoning to exclude and to limit the types of housing that can be built in certain neighborhoods. And that's had impacts on things like affordability and walkability. And thankfully, in Milwaukee, we have a pretty progressive tradition of planning. And I think we have a really great set of frameworks that have allowed for our city to evolve organically over time. And we have these great walkable neighborhoods. And we want to make sure that our current regulations continue to support that and support it citywide.
I mentioned that conversation with UW-Madison planning professor Kurt Paulson about a housing mismatch, not just in Milwaukee, but around the state. Here's a bit of that interview relevant to our conversation.
The market for years, given our zoning regulations and the financing, really preferred that large kind of new build suburban style house. So three or four bedrooms, right? 2,500 to 3,000 square feet. We build a lot of those, the large single-family homes, and then we build a lot of more urban apartments, one or two bedrooms. So a lot of planners, designers, policymakers are looking at what we call the missing middle. That's that in-between product we used to build a lot of in cities, right? This could be everything from boarding houses to what we call granny flats or accessory dwelling units. It's the duplex, the townhouse, the condos we were talking about. We just don't build a lot of that and have not for 40 years.
Sam, I want to pick up at that concept of the missing middle. I think I ran across that exact phrase in some of the materials about your project there in Milwaukee. Can you talk about how the plan you're trying to develop tackles that missing middle that might open housing up for a lot of people?
Yeah, thank you. I agree with what a lot of Professor Paulson said. Like a lot of cities across the country, we haven't seen a ton of that middle style of housing developed. But one of the things that sets Milwaukee apart in a good way is we're blessed with those styles of housing in many of our neighborhoods. Anyone who's familiar with the city, you know, if you picture your favorite city neighborhood, my guess is it's a neighborhood that has a variety of styles, small apartment buildings, duplexes, live-work units, mixed-use commercial development. So we're really blessed with the good bones, as people say. And in many of our city neighborhoods, we continue to allow that. There are some parts of the city where we don't currently permit that kind of middle style of housing. And we want to have a discussion around, you know, how and where should we continue to permit that. Now that's
talking to Sam Likling, city planning manager for the city of Milwaukee's Department of City Development, looking at a plan in the works, early stages to try to allow for more kinds of housing development in Milwaukee, meet more needs, ultimately bring more people into housing in the community. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Whether you are in Milwaukee yourself or not, are you seeing similar challenges where you live? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So, Sam, what kind of changes, and again, this is early stages, what kind of changes are you looking for that would allow more of that mix of housing to go to new and different neighborhoods, even where it's not currently part of the mix right now in Milwaukee?
Yeah, thanks. Some of the types of recommendations that we're pursuing is allowing those styles of housing, whether it's duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, in more parts of the city beyond where they're already permitted. We also want to look at something called accessory dwelling units. And that's a style of housing that everyone has a different name for. Some people might call it an in-law suite, a cottage house, a granny flat. Just acknowledging that, you know, as you talk about some of the demographic changes that we're seeing both statewide and locally, there's a significant need for housing choices that will allow people to age in place, that allow for intergenerational living. And we want to make sure that both our policy planning and our regulations both permit and encourage that. And, you know, we talked earlier about Professor Paulson's comments on those things just aren't being built. There's a few reasons for that. One is regulatory. And I think we certainly want to make sure our regulations support that. And another is economic. We know that the construction costs, financing costs, that's hard for anyone to navigate right now. And so we want to, at the same time, we're making sure our regulations permit and encourage that. we want to work creatively with other partners in the housing sector to say, how do we make sure that those options can also be attainable and accessible so they do continue to get built, just like they were, you know, as Milwaukee was growing as a city.
Another part of the proposal would also remove minimum parking requirements for some new housing development in Milwaukee. Why that change? What are the hopes for that?
Well, Milwaukee right now has some of the lowest requirements for parking in new developments of any city in the country. Again, we've kind of, that's a trend you're seeing across the country. Other cities move to either reduce or eliminate parking requirements. And that's a step that we took 20 or so years ago to advance our goals for walkable urban development and housing choice. Earlier this year, the City of Milwaukee's Common Council adopted a climate equity plan. And one of the recommendations of that climate equity plan was to continue to look at how we handle parking and transportation across the city to reduce the amount of vehicle miles per traveled per person and to work on achieving some of our climate goals, which rely on, you know, a denser form of development and hopefully reduce individual reliance on automobiles. And so as part of that climate equity plan, our policymakers have said we want to continue to explore if there's changes to our parking policies that will advance those goals. As planners, I think our ultimate goal is to just make sure that we're not putting artificial rules in place that encourage excess parking at developments. And thankfully, from our discussions with both existing developers and review of data, I don't think we're doing that here, but it's an option we need to, it's a topic we need to continue to explore to make sure that we're not driving up the cost of housing or negatively impacting our environmental sustainability and equity and climate goals by creating excess parking. And that's a part of the discussion we look forward to continuing to have throughout the Growing MKE project.
We're talking to the City of Milwaukee's planning manager, Sam Likling, about the Growing MKE initiative, which would update Milwaukee's zoning codes in an effort to promote more housing development, more different kinds of housing for people with different needs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Access to housing. A lot of communities are trying to tackle this problem right now. What are you seeing in your community? If you've been looking for a place to live, are you finding the kind of stuff that you need or having to go further away from where you work or settle for something smaller or maybe something bigger than you actually wanted? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up the conversation with Sam Likling, City Planning Manager for the Milwaukee Department of City Development. He's with us today to look at proposed changes to Milwaukee's zoning with a new initiative called Growing MKE, an effort to make more housing, more variety of housing available to more people. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 for this Growing MKE plan. What do you think about what you've heard? Do you like this idea? Are you curious? Do you have questions, whether you live in Milwaukee or beyond? And wherever you live, are you dealing with that mismatch between the kinds of houses that are available, if any, or rentals that are available, and what people actually want and need? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Sam, I want to talk a little bit about process. People might think, okay, the planners, the city council, they come up with a plan, they put it into place. No, it's a longer process than that. Can you talk about what goes into taking the starting point and making it a reality?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. And I think I want to start by just talking about the why we're doing that and how we get there. And I think the whole Growing MKE initiative is designed around translating that civic and community and leadership vision for the city we want to continue to grow into and the type of city we want to be. And then how do you translate that vision into regulations? And so the process that we are taking to do that is first, we're having those high level discussions with the public. We're talking to members of the public. We're talking to technical experts, developers, architects, and trying to have that discussion around vision. How do you see the future of housing growth and choice in Milwaukee? What are those choices that are missing? How do you see the continuing housing development meeting our goals for the walkable urban neighborhoods we all want? And we've spent the last few months having those discussions. And now we're at a point where we're ready to use all of our, you know, all that input we've gotten as, you know, as professional planners. It's now our job to say, if that's the vision, how do we have a land use policy and a zoning framework that support that? And we're ready to start sharing some of those recommendations with the public. We have a series of open houses scheduled in the next few weeks. On Monday, November 27th, we'll be at the Mitchell Street Library from 5:30 to 7 p.m. And then on Monday, December 4th, we'll be at the Good Hope Library, also from 5:30 to 7 p.m. And that's where we want to have some of those discussions of here's what we've heard. Here's the kind of feedback we've heard from people. Here's what their vision. And then here are the recommendations for how we think we can translate that vision into reality through planning and policy. We're also going to provide opportunities for people to take surveys, and all that's on our website. I should make sure to plug the website, sure. Of course, city.milwaukee.gov/growingMKE. People can sign up to get more information on the process, get notices when there's more materials and surveys. And then we're going to spend the next couple months taking that feedback. And then at some point in late spring of next year, presenting an amendment to the citywide policy plan to the Common Council that they hopefully will adopt. And then we'll take that action and move forward and begin to actually update the city's zoning code.
Let's bring on a caller. Lanny is with us in Ashland. Lanny, hi.
Hello, how are you today?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I just want to tell you I do have some experience in, you know, finding a place finally. You know, I live up here in northern Wisconsin, originally from Cincinnati, Ohio, and bounced around for a little while up here in northern Wisconsin, living in a motel over in Washburn and paying $650 a month just for one room, see? But then I wanted to move to Ashland. I finally found a place, but I guess what I want to tell the listeners is it's going to take a little time and, you know, work with the community agencies that in order that you might be get on the list finally. And then once you get on the list, you know, there's other places that will help you with rent and stuff. But I guess that anything I can really say is like I found a beautiful place in Ashland and, you know, they give you help. You know, I'm retired. I'm 72 years old. So, you know, the shelters are filled, you know, so wintertime's coming. So housing is very critical, you know, in the state.
Randy, I gotcha. We don't have a lot of time left, but thank you. And I'm glad you found housing. Sam, is there a room in this plan that for people who are in a precarious housing situation, homeless or on the verge, or as Lanny said, kind of bouncing around?
Yeah, that's, of course, we hear stories like Lanny's all the time. And it's great to hear that there's partners working on that up in Ashland. And we're really lucky to have partners working here in Milwaukee on how to meet the affordable housing needs of people across a wide variety of spectrums, wherever people find themselves in life, both from an age standpoint, income standpoint. The city of Milwaukee worked with a variety of partners in 2021 to create Milwaukee's Collective Affordable Housing Strategic Plan that was led by the Community Development Alliance. And it laid out a series of strategies to make sure that as a city, we're providing an affordable home for every Milwaukeean. And that's not something that you achieve just through zoning. There you have a variety of partners working to create new affordable rental homes, help existing homeowners preserve their homes, and help people achieve the goal of home ownership. And we have an amazing group of partners working on that here in Milwaukee. And we're just very lucky that we're have such a wide variety of partners working on those strategies because it is complex. There's no one single answer to those complex housing issues. And it's an initiative that we're happy to be part of in supporting the Community Development Alliance implement the Collective Affordable Housing Strategic Plan.
Just our last few moments, Sam, assuming this plan goes into place more or less as it is, when do you think we'd start to see more housing, maybe a decline in housing costs for people?
Well, the good news about a city is that it's always changing, and we are working with developers every day who want to bring new developments to the city of Milwaukee, and a lot of that can occur under our current zoning code and current land use regulations, and so you'll continue to see housing developed in Milwaukee. We think that if the zoning code's updates we're proposing, you'll just continue to see more of that. You'll continue to see housing development occur across the city at a wider mix of styles and in a pattern that will continue to allow Milwaukee to be just this really thriving, walkable, urban city that we all come to love. And so I'm really excited to get to work on this and excited to hear feedback from people over the next few months as they hear the recommendations and can provide input to us on how they align with their own goals for how Milwaukee should choose to grow.
Sam, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's Sam Likling, City Planning Manager from the Milwaukee Department of City Development. He's with us today to share details on proposed changes to Milwaukee's zoning codes and the city's growing MKE plan. He mentioned the link online where people in the community can comment on it. We'll post that at WPR.org/Central Time. And if you've got a story about efforts to improve access to housing in your community, wherever that might be, let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org.